Unless something really unexpected happens, it looks like Joe Biden is going to be the Democratic Party nominee for president. But can he beat Trump? And even if he does, will that really end Trumpism?
The idea that you will get rid of Trump, or at least beat Trumpism, by just returning to the same exact set of policies and conditions that led him to win power in the first place, it's just patently absurd.
That's Branko Marcetic. We talk with him about his just-released book about Joe Biden, Yesterday's Man. Then we air an interview I did last year for the Writer's Voice website with Wendell Potter about the full-court press against Medicare for All by industry and the politicians it funds. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Joe Biden is one of America's longest-serving politicians. He's also one of its least scrutinized. Now that it looks like he'll be the Democratic nominee, maybe it's time for a crash course on Uncle Joe and his long record in politics. That's just what we get in Branko Marcetic's new book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Marcetic argues that the electability claim for Biden is weak. But more than that, Biden's record indicates the candidate is simply not up to dealing with the profound crises of the 21st century, from climate catastrophe to income inequality to a broken healthcare system in a time of pandemics. Marcetic says that over nearly 50 years in politics, the man called Middle Class Joe served as a key architect of the Democratic Party's rightward turn, ushering in the end of the Liberal New Deal order and enabling the political takeover of the radical right. Far from being a liberal stalwart, Biden often outdid even Reagan, Gingrich, and Bush, assisting the right-wing war against the working class and ultimately paving the way for Trump. Strong words, but ones that Marcetic defends in this deep dive. Yesterday's Man is an essential read for anyone interested in knowing the real Joe Biden and what he might do in office. Branko Marcetic is a staff writer for Jacobin magazine. Well, Branko Marcetic, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice. In this terrific book, Yesterday's Man, you write that to return the United States to any vision of normality that won't just lead the country straight back to another Trump, the eventual Democratic nominee will have to do two things. They'll have to beat Donald Trump at the ballot box, thus removing him from the White House, and they'll need to midwife a fundamental break from the political status quo, removing or mending the conditions that led to his rise in the first place. Your book makes the case that Biden will not do the second and may well fail at the first. Why won't a return to pre-Trump, quote, normalcy, unquote, work?
Well, and to be clear, when I say that, I'm really just quoting Biden himself, who told a group of wealthy donors last year, I believe, that, quote, nothing would fundamentally change if he was president. So, you know, let's think about what that means for a second. The pre-Obama status quo, the normal that everyone is pining for right now, and that Biden is promising to take the country and the world back to, it was one where the U.S. was bombing, I think, eight different Muslim-majority countries with no declaration of war. It was one where the U.S. was mired in what seemed to be just an endless string of foreign conflicts, of completely needless foreign conflicts that just destabilized the globe, with Iraq and Afghanistan or Libya under Obama, or what's happening now in Ukraine, that the Trump administration has stepped up. It was a normal where people were going without health insurance. They were going without visiting a doctor, without getting treatment for things that they should be able to just get normal treatment for. It was a normal where poverty and homelessness in the country was climbing and getting bigger, and had been very big for a very long time. And these people had no one who was looking after their interests. in the halls of power. It was a normal where a group of criminals in the banking industry could detonate the entire economy and not just not be prosecuted for it at the same time that, you know, people of color were getting thrown to prison for having a tiny bit of marijuana in their pockets, but actually were rewarded for it by a huge bailout where they were given money that they then turned into record bonuses for executives. We can go on and on and on, but I mean, this is the so-called normal. I mean, well, before we move on, in fact, we might also think about the fact that a lot of Trump's immigration policies, yes, they're crueler and more offensive in every way to us than Obama's were. But make no mistake, Obama and Biden, they separated families, they put kids in cages, they put human beings in the same sort of concentration camps that we're seeing now, where they were mistreated, physically abused, sexually abused, psychologically abused. All of that was very normal until Trump came to office. And the idea that you will get rid of Trump, or at least beat Trumpism, by just returning to the same exact set of policies and conditions that led him to win power in the first place, it's just patently absurd.
Biden's fortunes were revived by his big win in South Carolina due to his endorsement by James Clyburn and support from older African Americans. Your book, Branko Marcetic, so it talks about a long history of Biden selling out the interests of the African American community for political gain. I wonder if you could talk about that record from, you know, the late 70s with anti-busing through his war on drugs and the mass incarceration crime bill of the late 80s.
Yeah, it's one of these historical ironies, these tragic ironies, where I think African-American voters have been, over the decades, so conditioned to have to settle for inadequate politicians that ultimately don't really share their goals and are very willing to let them down on many issues, that explains the support for Biden right now. I mean, I think the other thing is, of course, he is he's a known quantity. He was, of course, associated with Obama, and he has also been relentlessly pushed by the media for over a year now as the most, quote, electable and safe choice, a designated driver to take on Trump. And so for all those reasons, I think people, particularly in the South, which is more conservative, of course, the black community is not exactly the same all over the country. But I think that explains the support he's receiving there. I mean, the irony there is, as you say, Biden has really throughout his career selectively betrayed voters, African-American voters, on certain issues while courting the support and getting it. The war on crime and drugs is maybe the most glaring example, because this was something that Biden did out of political expediency. He was well aware that punitive measures were not really helpful. He had criticized Reagan for them. He also knew by the 90s that the crime rate was falling, and he was actually telling people, no, don't listen to the statistics. It's much worse than the statistics suggest. Mm. And Biden's bills, which include not just the 1994 crime bill, but a series of bills in the 80s, some of which he worked on with Strom Thurmond, the former segregationist Strom Thurmond, which, you know, that should give you a clue about, you know, the virtue of some of the stuff. You know, for example, the 80s stuff, it set up the 100-to-1 crack to powder cocaine sentencing ratio, where people who had crack cocaine, who were more likely to be black, were sentenced at 100 times the rate of people with powder cocaine who are more likely to be white. All these bills exploded the system of mass incarceration in the United States, which of course has mostly affected black and brown people, but also poor people of all races. Beyond that, the bills that he pushed, for example, eliminated parole. There were bills he pushed that gutted habeas corpus in the 90s, which made it a lot harder for people on death row to appeal their convictions and to get out of being executed, which, you know, we're seeing, It was just last week that I can't remember which state, but a southern state executed a completely innocent man, and this happens constantly, and it's the amount of appeals has actually dropped, plummeted really, because of the bill that Biden pushed in the 90s. He also pushed for the expansion of civil forfeiture, which basically just lets the police take your stuff if they so much as just accuse you of a crime. They don't have to charge you with anything. They can just stop you, if you're a motorist and say, well, we think that this was that you're engaged in some sort of criminal activity, and we're going to take this money or this property, whatever it is, because we think that a car. Yeah, exactly. We think that
house.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, whole houses have been taken. And then, they use that to either, sometimes they use it to fund parties. That has happened. Other times they just use it to plug up budget deficits in their police budgets. And that was Biden that pushed that. We could also talk about his anti-busing activism. Well, I shouldn't say activism. It's anti-busing work, I guess, in the Senate, which, again, for political expediency, he was a reliable vote for busing until about 1975. Then he starts getting a lot of pressure from anti-busing activists in Delaware. And looking at his re-election in 1978, he decides he has to move far to the right on this. And he becomes probably the leading anti-busing liberal in the Senate. He brags about this for years afterwards. And he just votes relentlessly against busing. And people know this record, but I think they don't know the full significance of what Biden did. Because, for example, he put forward a 1975 amendment, an anti-busing amendment, which did not clear Congress, but it did pass the Senate. And it was remarkable at the time, this was a watershed moment, that the Senate, for the first time, that Biden's amendment, even though it ultimately failed, just by passing the Senate, it cracked this coalition that existed in the Senate to always vote for desegregation measures. And there was this watershed that the Senate, which could be counted on to reliably pass this stuff, had now finally, its commitment had wavered. And that was because of Biden's bill, and he was very happy about it at the time. The lasting achievement he got on this was a 1977 Eagleton-Biden amendment, which was renewed for every year for several years after that. And it was motivated in theory by the court-ordered busing that was going on in Wilmington in Delaware at the time that Biden was trying to posture to save his political skin. But Biden's amendment ultimately didn't have anything to do with the courts. It forbade what was then the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare from spending money on busing. And so it had no effect on the situation in Wilmington. But it was cited by educators and by civil rights workers for years after as the biggest impediment to desegregation, because even voluntary school desegregation plans couldn't be fully completed because of Biden's ban on HEW money being put towards busing. And that's, we could also talk about his work in the 90s on welfare reform and how devastating that's been to communities. We could, to communities of color. We could talk about his bankruptcy bill in 2005 and how terrible that has been for all middle class and working class families of all races.
Actually, could you talk a little bit about that bankruptcy bill? I don't think a lot of people understand how much of an impact that bankruptcy bill has had on middle class families, including the fact that medical debt, student debt, and how it helped to lead to the crisis of 2008.
Yeah, I mean, this was past the time that credit card debt was exploding across the United States. And I mean, that's sort of the dirty secret of the prosperity of the 90s is that I think a good chunk of it was built on just credit. And Biden, who had a close relationship with MBNA, which is a credit card company in Delaware, they were his biggest actually contributor throughout his career. His son worked for them. They even paid his son as a consultant after he left the company as Biden was pushing this bill. And they wanted this bill passed because what it did do was it made it much more difficult for middle-class families to declare bankruptcy and to discharge their debts. It put a means test on that. Mm. So it basically excluded a whole bunch of people. And it put a whole host of onerous conditions on discharging bankruptcy. You had to take a educational lessons on credit and all this other kind of stuff. There were all these costs that were added onto it. There was actually a bankruptcy judge described it as one of the worst written bills he'd ever seen, and they complained about it as they were having to sort of follow the rules and deny people the ability to declare bankruptcy. They complained about how terrible the bill was. It's had long-running implications beyond that, because students now can't declare bankruptcy on the student debt. That's because of Biden. And of course, in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis, you have a lot of people who are underwater and who are stuck, because this bankruptcy bill just closes yet one more door for them to be able to get out of this financial nightmare that they are in. And I mean, yeah, we could talk about his vote for the Glass-Steagall repeal, which made the crisis even worse, because it got rid of the thing that was separating investment and other banking, basically, and it allowed these banks to become huge and have feet in several different parts of the industry, which meant when they failed, it was much more devastating. And it also meant that these banks were basically gambling with people's deposits and savings and that kind of thing. Biden voted for that, as did a lot of Democrats. And, we haven't even talked about his votes against Social Security and Medicare to cut these over the years, over the decades.
Let's do that as well, because that's been something that he claims that he's now for expanding Social Security and Medicare. Talk about that. How much do you believe his current stance, and tell us his record on this?
Well, Biden's current stance is supposedly that he will protect Medicare and Social Security. Of course, if you look at Biden's career, Biden has always shown a propensity to say, whatever he needs to say at any given moment, and then say something else any other given moment, depending on who's listening and whether it's advantageous. So the idea that Biden is going to definitely protect these programs if he becomes president, to me, is very dubious. If you look at his record, I mean, Biden has been trying to cut this stuff for 40 years, as people have been fond of saying. He bragged about it for many years. He had his spending freeze bill that he put forward with Republicans, which was even more stingy than Reagan's, was meant to put a freeze on Social Security and Medicare as well. He called throughout the 90s for the retirement age to be raised, for cuts to Medicare, that something had to be finally done for Medicare. He voted 3 years in a row for the balanced budget constitutional amendment. That was a huge, important plank of Newt Gingrich's Contract for America. It failed to pass the Senate by one or two votes every single year that he voted for it. So he got it very, very close to the line. It came very close to passing with his help. And if that had passed, even though there was one version that did protect or insulate Social Security from these spending cuts, but the others didn't, economists warned that having the balanced budget, having a mandate to balance the budget every year, or at least balance it by huge spending cuts, would be devastating for the economy. It would undermine the government's attempts to deal with financial crises when you have to run up deficits to be able to invest into the economy. Basically, it would, in fact, as Biden himself said, it would make Herbert Hoover's economic policy the law of the land. And he voted for it anyway. And again, several of those were ones he voted for that explicitly did not protect Social Security and Medicare. So if it had passed, that was the big goal of the Republicans. And they even said this out loud, that ultimately, it would allow them to take on Social Security. Under Obama, Biden was constantly sent by Obama to negotiate and talk to Mitch McConnell and the Republicans as they sort of made these hostage scenarios where they would try and draw from the Obama administration cuts to government spending and that kind of thing, huge cuts as a result of their support for raising the debt ceiling or what have you, or in Obama's attempts to find a grand bargain with the GOP, all this kind of stuff. Biden was the chief negotiator with all that, because it was thought that, well, he has experience and he knows all these guys, so he'll be able to get along with them. And of course, that's not how it worked. In reality, Biden just rolled over and allowed himself to be completely steamrolled by Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. He gave away everything. And it's a miracle that it wasn't worse than it was. It was only because of Republican obstinacy, really, that this didn't end up happening. But, I mean, if you think about what Biden has been saying already on the campaign trail, that he's going to work with the Republicans, you think about what Mitch McConnell and the Republicans have been saying, which is, well, the deficit is so huge, because we made it so huge, that now we have to really start taking a look at these programs like Social Security and Medicare. I mean, it does not take a rocket scientist to think about what that's going to mean under President Biden. What exactly is he going to work with Mitch McConnell and the Republicans on, if not taking aim at these entitlements and saying, as Biden's been saying for decades, to raise the retirement age. I think that is a very, very high likelihood of happening.
Wow. Now, you've really been pointing out how much he has worked with Republicans. He's even given money to Republican candidates over Democratic candidates in certain cases. But you go even beyond that in this book, Branko Marcetic, in Yesterday's Man, to say that Biden has actually been worse than Republicans on many issues. But let's take the ones that erode constitutional rights, like the Patriot Act and others.
I'll just preface that by saying that Biden's, one of the patterns of Biden's career is that whenever there is a panic, and particularly when it's right-wing engineered panics, so, you know, drugs, crime, terrorism, spending, government spending, Biden ends up going even further to the right than people on the right in order to show that hey, I can be just as conservative and kind of extreme on these issues as anyone else. And the civil liberties aspect is one of these things. I mean, Biden initially pushed this terrorist bill in the 90s, anti-terrorist bill, in the wake of the Timothy McVeigh attack in Oklahoma City. And he, you know, very much jumped on board with this and put forward a whole host of extreme measures, one of which was the gutting of habeas corpus, which he had failed to do in the 80s and the early 90s. And some of these things didn't make it in that particular bill, but they later popped up in the Patriot Act, which Biden also voted for. And he also told people, he boasted to people at the time, you know, I basically wrote the Patriot Act. And actually, he admonished the Senate for not voting in even harsher measures. He said, I want to go even further, but the rest of the Senate didn't want to. You know, again, it's that kind of posturing, trying to show, No, I'm actually tougher and more extreme than the conservatives on my right. When September 11 happens, of course, in the midst of all this fear, Biden starts warning of, well, the next terrorist attacks are going to come through the subways. There's going to be gas and bombs and who knows. Terrorists are probably going to get nuclear weapons. You know, we're sitting ducks, all this kind of thing. Really firing up panic and fear and hysteria at a time when that was, I mean, it's never unhelpful, but when it's extremely unhelpful in that moment. And we can go back to the 80s and the 90s where Biden was pushing for things like a drug czar, a centralized post to coordinate the war on drugs, that even people like Reagan and Rudy Giuliani, you know, Rudy Giuliani, not someone who's known for particularly being soft on crime, thought that was going too far and that was a little over the top. You know, in the 90s, even as the crime rate was dropping, there was a Justice Department report in the early 90s that said the crime was dropping. There were FBI statistics that showed this. And Biden was telling people, no, don't listen to the statistics. It's much worse than what the statistics say. There is carnage going on in the streets of America right now. This is terrible. You know, he would say these things. He would paint these lurid pictures of the situation in Europe. Where he said, you know, basically Europe was this hellhole that was covered with used syringes and there were just, you know, all the young people were shooting up in parks and that kind of thing. He was saying that the war on drugs and crime was just as much of a national security issue as nuclear war or war with the Soviet Union. And this, you know, we could again name many, many, many examples like this. But The fundamental aspect of Biden's career is that whenever there's any of this kind of panic, and particularly when it's being fanned by the right, Biden feels the need to not so much to take a stand against it and promote an alternative narrative and try and persuade people to think a different way, but to accept that frame of thinking and lean into it harder than even his opponents do. And, you know, as we look at a world that is about to be hit by a confluence of crises, a whole host of different things, whether it's illnesses like coronavirus, whether it's suddenly just ecosystems collapsing around the world, what have you, it bears thinking what that means to have someone like Biden who gets swept up in every hysteria that has hit the United States in his lifetime, what it'll mean to have him in power during that time.
Yes, and maybe caught up in that hysteria, but not in a way to actually deal with the problem itself. I mean, we know that The Sunshine Movement gave him an F on his climate plan. He's being bankrolled by the fossil fuel industry. But I want to now talk about the electability issue, because this is an other part. You have been talking about how his policies have been at the forefront of pushing the situation that we face today, the neoliberal agenda that has brought us to a world in crisis. I wonder if you could talk about the electability argument. You know, as you said in the beginning, you mentioned a bit about why they, you know, why he's not electable in the same line of candidates such as Hillary Clinton. But there are even greater problems with Biden at this point.
The idea that Biden is the electable and the safe choice against Trump and that Sanders is the risky one is a testament to the effectiveness of media and Democratic propaganda over the last 40 years. Because this is the claim, you know, Democrats and the people that like them in the media, they all point to George McGovern as an example of why a kind of left-wing or too liberal politician could never win in the United States. So there's that one loss that gets pointed to again and again that was nearly 40 years ago. Meanwhile, you look at the track rate of centrism and, you know, and there's an effort to cast all these candidates that Democrats pushed, you know, after the fact as these kind of unelectable liberals. But in actual fact, they ran very cautious centrist campaigns, and they've all been obliterated by Republicans. Jimmy Carter, who was a centrist conservative Democrat, who was, you know, who wanted to deregulate things and he hated government spending, he was destroyed by Reagan in 1980. And Reagan was considered an electoral risk at the time. Walter Mondale, who the superdelegates in 1984 put the thumb of their scales on the scales for, because they felt he was a more safe electable choice than Jesse Jackson, for instance, he was obliterated by Reagan in an even worse landslide. Michael Dukakis, who was even more of a centrist, and by the way, Mondale had run a campaign trying to on cutting the deficit, you know, trying to out Reagan. Michael Dukakis, who runs a sort of austerity campaign, he gets defeated by Bush. You have Bill Clinton, who does win, but he wins on a platform that, yes, it dog whistles towards racists, but also it combines it with an economic populism. He wants to reform healthcare and that kind of thing. And he has a semi-ambitious social agenda that unfortunately he abandons as soon as he comes to office for more deficit cutting. But he does win because it's a slightly different message from the rest of these. Then we get into Gore, who again is a centrist Democrat who is backed by the party's wealthy interests. He loses to Bush. We have John Kerry. Again, you could have gone for Howard Dean, someone who had a clear contrast to President Bush in the kind of policies that he pushed, especially on his steadfast opposition to the Iraq War. But the Democrats said, no, we'll go with Kerry because he is more conventionally acceptable to the electorate, or at least the sort of mythical swing voter, because he didn't really oppose the war. He's kind of like Bush, but a little more competent. He loses by an even worse margin to Bush than Gore did. And in 2016, again, Hillary Clinton, the safe, dependable choice, the establishment-friendly choice, the one that every piece of conventional wisdom in Washington said that would be the best candidate to field against a Republican, let alone someone as odious and cartoonishly repellent as Trump. And she loses. And now the party is on track to nominate someone who is almost exactly like her, has the exact same weaknesses, whether you're talking about family corruption, whether you're talking about mass incarceration that Biden has a much worse record on than Hillary Clinton, whether you're talking about the Iraq War, which again, Biden has a much worse record on than Hillary Clinton, talking about the pushing of trade deals like NAFTA and TPP, or, you know, wanting to cut Medicare and Social Security, with which Trump disingenuously said that he would, well, ran on protecting in 2016 and will certainly cut, but will run to Biden's left. All this stuff makes Biden a far from ideal choice to face Trump. And then that is on top of the fact that Biden is clearly not the same Joe Biden of 4 years ago, let alone 8 years ago, let alone the rest of his career. This is a man who is forgetting Obama's name repeatedly. This is a man who can't remember the opening of the Declaration of Independence. This is a man who has such problems with speaking and forming coherent thoughts that, and by the way, this is a thing that was widely remarked upon in 2019 by Democratic candidates and analysts, media analysts on CNN and other networks. This is not some sort of conspiracy theory cooked up by Trump and the far left as they're trying to paint it as now. But this is a man who we're seeing is having a lot of difficulty just even really making coherent, unscripted speeches. And that his own campaign is trying to hide from any public appearances. He's not doing interviews. He barely speaks at his own events. Jim Clyburn, his endorser in South Carolina, suggested the DNC should just step in and cancel the next debate so that Biden doesn't go out and embarrass himself. This is the person that they are considering, on top of all of his policy failures, that they're considering to put up against Trump. And the last thing I'll say is that in 2008, the United States had a similar choice with someone with a more aspirational, or the Democratic electorate, I should say, had a similar choice between a more aspirational, idealistic, and conventionally risky choice and the more conventionally safe electable choice in the form of Hillary Clinton. And just as you're seeing now, in 2008, older voters went overwhelmingly for Clinton and younger voters went for Obama. And what happened in that campaign? You know, when we were told again and again, well, Obama, you know, he's an African-American man. He has a middle name, Hussein. He's too liberal. All of this is going to make him unelectable against the Republican. This is a disaster if we elect him instead of Hillary Clinton, who is the safe choice. The same people who are saying the same things now. And what happened? Obama not only won, he won two terms. And he is now, I mean, I think he was, you know, in many ways a failure. But regardless, he is now considered maybe the greatest Democratic president of you know, the last 100 years. Beloved within the party, you know, people pined for the days that he was in power. They wished that he could run again. So, you know, I would ask people listening to think about who's telling you what now and what did they say about 2008 and when have they really been right in their prognostications of who can and cannot win?
Well, let me ask you a final question then. Why? Why are they putting up a candidate who they must know will most likely lose to Trump unless, you know, perhaps the pandemic delivers a win to any Democrat?
Well, let's look at the Democratic Party and how it functions. I mean, you look at where past high-ranking Democratic officials have ended up. People like Tom Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader. People like Howard Dean, who was the progressive insurgent in 2004. Or, you know, okay, let's look at also people like Chris Dodd, for example. They went on to be lobbyists for various powerful corporate interests, the exact kind of corporate interests that Sanders is now running against and saying he wants to shift the party away from. Not only that, but what has the Democratic Party done under Trump? I mean, for all the talk of Trump being a dictator and the new Hitler and all this kind of stuff, the Democratic Party doesn't seem to really believe that. They voted numerous times to give this you know, this new Hitler record-breaking military budgets. They've voted numerous times to expand his powers to spy on the public. They don't seem to have really put up much of a fight over his what he's doing to migrants in those camps. They've funded, actually, in fact, they've voted to fund those atrocities.
The kids in cages.
The kids in cages, the family separation, the horrible, horrible mistreatment of all people who are desperately seeking a better life in the United States. It's clear to me that the Democratic Party does not really believe its own rhetoric. And in fact, at the same time, this has been the last 4 years have been very good for the Democratic Party. They're getting record donations. Mm. They won the House in the back of anti-Trump opposition in 2018. People like Nancy Pelosi get these viral moments from ripping a speech or refusing to shake Trump's hand or what have you. Lots of admiring messages and lots of media attention for these kind of big performative things that they do against Trump. And I would put it to you that and this is not going to be every single person in the Democratic Party, but there is, I think, a significant contingent of people in the party that are fundamentally more comfortable with playing the opposition to Trump for four more years than they would be with changing the Democratic Party, reorienting itself from big money donors and corporate interests, and changing how it does politics. Because what that means is there's no longer these cushy jobs that happen when you leave Congress. There isn't, you know, maybe if the Democratic Party was suddenly hostile to corporate interests instead of so welcoming of them, you know, the next administration wouldn't, like Obama's did, end up going to work for companies like McDonald's and Amazon and Uber, as so many of these Obama alumni have. And I think for them, I think they would rather risk another 4 years of Trump than to have Sanders come in and suddenly turn off the tap, you know, have the gravy train stop running, and change things so much that the party has to reorient itself and fundamentally reconsider what it is. That is what I think. And frankly, the fact that they are all rallying around a candidate who is as flawed as Biden, who very obviously cannot cut it and will not cut it in the general election against Trump, I think shows where their priorities lie.
Well, that's a tragic comment on the lack of our democracy. Branko Marcetic, your book is Yesterday's Man. It's absolutely a terrific book. Thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
No, thanks for having me.
Branko Marcetic is staff writer for Jacobin. Go to writersvoice.net for links to recent articles he wrote about Biden, including one titled "Joe Biden's Budget-Cutting Dogma is a Threat to Public Health." Next up, Wendell Potter and the War Against Medicare for All. Stay tuned after the break. Bernie Sanders doesn't seem to have a path to the Democratic nomination anymore after his recent losses in the primaries. But the platform he's running on, like Medicare for All and paid sick leave, is, in this age of the COVID-19 pandemic, if anything, more relevant. As Sanders said in a recent fireside chat, we are all only as safe as the least insured person among us. When people can't afford to get medical care, they're a source of infection for everyone. Since we last talked with healthcare industry author and analyst Wendell Potter last March, several well-respected studies have come out saying that Medicare for All would save our healthcare system hundreds of billions of dollars per year and tens of thousands of lives. COVID-19 has amplified that message by orders of magnitude. The pandemic is showing in stark relief the profound failures of our for-profit healthcare system to protect us. Joe Biden said in the last debate that Medicare for All wasn't working for Italy during the pandemic. It's true, Italy is being hit hard because it didn't impose widespread testing and strict social distancing until the epidemic had taken hold. But without single-payer healthcare in Italy, the terrible toll of the virus would be far worse. We in the U.S. are likely about to find that out. Here's my 2019 interview with Wendell Potter, airing for the first time on broadcast. We posted it as a web extra on writersvoice.net last March. The health insurance industry is mounting a full-court press against Medicare for All. One big way they're doing that is spreading their talking points to politicians on both sides of the aisle who've taken big donations from them. Wendell Potter had an inside seat to the process when he was a health insurance executive for Cigna. He repudiated all that to blow the whistle on the industry with his books Deadly Spin and Nation on the Take. Potter went on to find the website Tarbell, which does investigative journalism on the healthcare industry. This week, he wrote a post on Tarbell about one of those politicians he says is on the take, the new chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or DCCC, Cheryl Bustos. I called up Wendell Potter to find out more. Well, Wendell Potter, thanks so much for talking with us here. you wrote a post about an article published by The Hill, a story that they published earlier in March. DCCC chief says Medicare for All price tag, quote, a little scary. So this new chief of the DCCC is Representative Sherry Bustos of Illinois. Tell us about her in the context of this post.
Well, I was not necessarily surprised to see that headline because earlier, mid-year last year, just before the New York primary, which Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was taking on Joe Crowley in a district in New York, I was looking to see how much money Crowley had taken from healthcare special interests, and I was looking to see in particular which members of Congress had taken the most from the five largest health insurance companies and their political action committees. And lo and behold, Crowley was right up there in the top five, but heading the list was Sherry Bustos. So I was not a bit surprised to see that story. She has a history also of working for a big hospital system, big integrated healthcare system in the Midwest. So I thought it was important to help people understand just where she's coming from and the fact that she has become someone who is really quite expert at taking sizable checks from big special interests and certainly those from healthcare.
You write that she was vice president of corporate communications for a big hospital system. What is the skin in the game that the hospital systems have, you know, when we're talking about Medicare for All?
They're very much involved. In fact, there's this organization, I call it an organization, it's really not that. It's more of a front group that was formed last year by health insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and big hospital chains through their trade associations, the American Hospital Association and the Federation of American Hospitals, which is the for-profit hospital organization. And they're pooling their money, all these parts of healthcare, to finance collectively this campaign against Medicare for All. And the hospitals are against it because they've got a good thing going. One of the things I often tell people is that it's not really accurate to think that health insurance companies are really all that much in the game to control healthcare costs. They're not. They can't for one reason or another. Nor do they have a reason to do it or an interest in doing it, because the more healthcare costs go up, the more money they get or able to demand from us in premiums. Hospitals are in on the game, in that because health insurance companies cannot really control healthcare costs, they can pretty much have their way with them. So they like the system as it is. They get more money from private insurers than they do from the current Medicare program or for the Medicaid program, and it's because of the weakness and the smallness, if you will, of individual private insurance companies.
Wow, and yet they're pretty big. Nonetheless, a huge part of our economy. You talk about Bustos getting the most contributions from the PACs of all five of the biggest for-profit health insurers, Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and United Health Group. You say she's being supplied with talking points by the health insurance industry. What are her talking points?
Well, here's how it works. If you are on the take from big industries, you're more willing and your staff is more willing to see a lobbyist from those who are writing those big checks. And some of the talking points here are that this country can't afford Medicare for All, that it would cost too much money, and that so many Americans get their coverage to their workplace that we need to be mindful of that as we're looking at Medicare for All. Those are talking points directly from the insurance industry and this partnership that I mentioned to scare people, to make them think that this is really not something that we should strive for, that there are these reasons why we shouldn't even give it any consideration. It is true. Most Americans who are not enrolled in Medicare or Medicaid or some other public program do get their coverage through private insurers. That's the way it's been in this country for many, many decades. But it doesn't mean it always has to be that way. And the reality also is that many people who are enrolled, in fact, an increasing probably majority of people enrolled in private insurance plans, and in particular those through the workplace, are finding that their coverage is increasingly less valuable, even though they're paying more for it, they and their employers, every single year. So I know that in reality, a lot of people are very dissatisfied with what they're getting for the high premiums they're paying, and they're having to pay more and more out of their own pockets these days for coverage, even if they have insurance. But that's one of those talking points. It is to try to make policymakers and the public believe that for some reason our employer-based system is sacred. We can't touch it.
Yes, I remember the last time I got health insurance through an employer. I'm now on Medicare. But at that time, they instituted a new program called Value Plus, and I used to joke that it was more like Value Minus because I was paying a lot more for a lot less.
Right. In fact, one of my last CEOs in the health insurance business at Cigna, someone asked him what kept him up at night, and he said it is the worry that employers and individuals will wake up and question the value proposition of health insurers, which is a wonky, jargony term that's often used in business, certainly in health insurance. And I think employers and individuals are waking up to question, and rightfully so, the value proposition. What value do they actually bring to this country? And it's questionable. One of the things I used to have to do for a living was to try to make people believe that we had a reason to exist. But increasingly, employers in particular are questioning the reason why we have this middleman in the equation in the first place.
Yeah, and let's go to some of the other talking points. She was saying $33 trillion price tag for Medicare for all is just too much. You counter that. How do you counter that?
Well, that actually is only part of the number that from this think tank, actually a conservative think tank that came up with that number. So she's quoting that. But even that think tank said that is at least $2 trillion less over 10 years than what it would be if we continue with the current system. So in other words, even that, yes, that's a big number, but it's over 10 years, first of all. And what she did not tell or say was that would represent less money that the country would spend on health care if we go to Medicare for all than if we don't. The reality is that we currently, this year, we'll spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare as a country. So you multiply that by 10, you've already gotten over $30 trillion, $35 trillion, and that is just based on the assumption that there will be no medical inflation, which of course that's something you have to factor in that. So if we stick with what we've got, we will be spending a heck of a lot more than $33 trillion over the course of the next 10 years. So it's very disingenuous for her to use that number out of context as she did.
Now, the third talking point is think of all the jobs that are going to be lost for the people who are processing all those claims or, you know, denying all those claims.
Right. And I think that it's a talking point to obscure the reality that the work that they do makes it, in many cases, impossible for the rest of us, the many millions of us, to get the care that we need. A lot of these folks, as you pointed out, they're employed to try to avoid paying claims. Because we have a multi-payer system, which is unique in the world, insurance companies not only have armies of employees who are in the business of determining whether or not someone should get coverage for whatever it is a doctor recommends, but you also, on the provider side, have to have armies of people who do nothing more than deal with insurance company bureaucrats day in and day out. So you've got these tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are employed in our healthcare system who do not do anything to make us better or to help us with our health. In fact, in many cases, it keeps us from getting the care that we need. The other point I would make is that, two points actually, insurance companies have employed literally tens of thousands of nurses who are not providing care, but they are working for these big insurance companies, in many cases standing in the way of the care that we need, and medical directors, doctors as well. So in my view, those folks, they've been trained as caregivers, they should be back at the bedside or providing care in their offices rather than making it more difficult for us to get care. The other thing is that most of these big insurance companies have diversified over the years. They would not go out of business if we move tomorrow to a Medicare for All plan. They've got other lines of businesses that are really quite profitable and are growing. So it's a fallacy to say that these companies will go out of business, and some people would need to be retrained. Some of them have great training, like doctors and nurses, and could go straight away to work at a better place, in my opinion.
Wendell Potter, you don't talk about the following thing in your piece, but it's another talking point I've heard coming more from, let's say, the center left. You know, many people in the Democratic Party are saying they're for Medicare for all, although they're beginning to hedge on some of that. And some of them are saying, some of the candidates for 2020 candidates are saying, well, we just want universal coverage and we can do it with the kinds of plans that, let's say, Switzerland has, or Germany or Holland, where there are private nonprofit insurance companies that the government pays them and bargains with them. So what is the best way to do Medicare for all?
Right, and I've heard that too, obviously. My response is, why in the world would you not want to do the best job? Why would you want to emulate another country that, yes, they have achieved universal coverage, but they're kind of runners-up with us in terms of how much they spend on health care. We spend almost $10,000 per person per year on health care, which is twice the average of other developed countries, and we have worse outcomes than most of those countries. So we have very little to show for all that we're spending. But Switzerland comes in second in terms of the amount of money that the country spends on health care. Germany's not too far behind. The thing that is distinctive about those countries, that usually those folks you mentioned who advocate for them, is that the insurance companies, or sickness funds as they may be called in those countries, they're heavily regulated, price regulated, they're all nonprofit entities, and we've moved far away from that kind of a structure many decades ago. So insurance companies would be just as resistant to a proposal like that, that would force them into nonprofit status, as Medicare for All. Why do we want to do a half measure? Why do we want to postpone what is inevitable, which is moving to a single-payer healthcare system? And it is the one system of those that are proposed that not only would get us to universal coverage, but would save us the most money. It's a goal. In fact, when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, policymakers knew that we needed to try to do something about health care cost while also trying to achieve the goal of universal coverage. Policymakers decided during the Obama administration to go first for universal coverage and deal with health care costs later. We see where we wound up. We wound up with a bill that does a great deal of good in terms of bringing a lot of us into coverage, but there's still about 30 million of us who are uninsured. And the other problem is that a fast-growing percentage of us are underinsured because of the way that law was structured and the way that the insurance industry has been going, which is to move every last one of us into a high-deductible plan. And increasingly, those of us who are low and moderate income have trouble meeting our deductible, so we go without care. That's the definition of underinsurance. So why do we want to do second best or third best? Why don't we just do something that really gets us to where we need to be rather than just continuing to tinker with the system that has failed us for many years?
Another thing that I've heard coming out with some of the candidates, and I'm thinking of maybe Jay Inslee, proposals to decrease the Medicare eligibility age to, say, 55 or 50. In other words, an incremental approach. And to the other one is to provide a public option that businesses and people could buy into. In other words, people could buy into Medicare. What are your thoughts on those?
Well, you know, it would be better than not doing anything, I guess. But why, again, do you want to settle for something that is not as good as you can try to get?
Well, the reason is politics. That's what they're
saying. The reason is politics. But like I said, you can expect as much resistance to that as you would to going boldly. In fact, I'm blanking on his name right now, but one of the historians, American historians, was interviewed on TV not too long ago, and he was saying, often if you look at American history or history broadly, you'll see that sometimes it's easier to achieve sweeping change by bold moves than by incremental change. Incremental change can be incredibly tough to pull off. Sometimes bold measures are more successful. But back to that specific proposal, it would add complications to the system. It would not simplify it. And you would keep the insurance industry in place for however long, maybe indefinitely. And it is our multi-payer system that is at the heart of our problem with costs being out of control and the complexity of our system. Instead of simplifying the system, it just adds greater complexity. And I just see that as a real cop-out to being able to get where we need to be. It does nothing to curb the practices of the insurance industry that are putting more and more of us into the ranks of the underinsured, for example, which is limiting the choices of doctors and hospitals we have in these so-called limited or narrow networks that are in vogue among health insurance companies now. In fact, almost all of them have limitations on the doctors and hospitals you can see. They're forcing you to pay more and more for prescription medications by putting more and more drugs in tiers that cost you more or require that you pay more out of your own pocket. They're making you pay more out of your own pocket broadly through high deductibles. Why do we want to keep a system in place that makes us pay more for care out of our own pockets, even if we have insurance, and to pay more and more every year in premiums? Now, that doesn't make sense to me, and I can't imagine why policymakers would propose that we keep a system like that in place just because it might be easier. It makes no sense to me.
This is affecting cancer drugs too, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, I draw your attention to a piece that is on Tarbell now, written by a leading oncologist from MD Anderson in Houston, about the cost of oncology drugs, in particular cancer drugs. And it's just extraordinary what has happened to the price of pharmaceuticals broadly, but in particular for cancer drugs. And insurance companies are just largely on the sidelines because they are not large enough, not any of them, even the biggest, have enough clout to really do anything to control drug prices. All they are able to do is shift us, require that we take one drug as opposed to another that our doctor might have recommended, or again, shift those medications into tiers that make us pay more. So they're not controlling costs. They're shifting more of the cost to us. And in many cases, as he's pointed out to me, this doctor who wrote that piece, he's seen patients die for economic reasons. They just simply can't figure out the resources to get the medications or the treatments that they need.
Well, Wendell Potter, this has just been really great to have you talking with us here. Thanks so much. And we'll keep on staying tuned to Tarbell, your investigative reporting site on the healthcare industry.
Thank you very much, Francesca. Yes, please check out tarbell.org.
That was Wendell Potter talking with Writer's Voice in March of 2019. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.